You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Julia Fierro, whose debut novel, Cutting Teeth, was published by St. Martin's Press just last month. Julia is the founder of Brooklyn's Sackett Street Writers Workshop, and is also an alumnus of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, as so many of our authors are. Cutting Teeth is a story about five couples, in the loosest sense of the word, plus one Buddhist, who interact with one another. their relationships as adults being pretty much almost 100% informed by their own children. So the aforementioned characters are all part of a play group, which is, you know, today's world, a small society that has become, especially among a certain socioeconomic demographic, and especially in New York, a kind of microcosm of a certain kind of America. The action takes place over a weekend retreat over the Labor Day weekend on Long Island. It's kind of an end of summer trip to wind down before the world starts up again. However, what is originally planned as a pleasant few days with friends, in quotes kind of, and their children, turns into a kind of dystopic world of sorts, having some Jonathan Franzen thrown in, along with a dash of Mary McCarthy and a soupçon of maybe Fellini. welcome, Julia. Thanks so much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much for having me on the Avid Reader, and thank you so much for that amazing summary. That was... It made me want to read my own book.
Yeah, I wanted to read it again, too.
That was great. I love that. You know, I'm also Italian. My father immigrated later in his life, so the Fellini reference is especially exciting.
Well, it's you know, I don't mean it in the sense that it's, like, totally bizarre. I just mean every once in a while something happens that kind of turns your head upside down, which is good because it's great for the reader to think, oh, wait, what? And then you got to go, and then you flip backwards, which is always a good sign when you flip backwards.
No, I really, you know, and I mean, I think what you said, too, it's really fascinating, this idea of this little group, this little play group, you know, being this microcosm. I think that's so true, and I think it's very true also for the parenting experience in those early years when, you know, it's hard to leave your house, it's hard to leave your neighborhood, and so you turn to the people who are closest to you, which in many cases is sort of like, it's like friendship out of sort of convenience. So they're not necessarily, you know, if you're lucky, you might, you know, meet someone that really actually has a lot in common with you other than being a parent. But often they're just sort of people that maybe you wouldn't have become friends with in non-parenting life.
Yeah, I mean, when I read, well, first of all, one of the best things you did was do the little family tree at the beginning, because first I'm thinking, I'll never keep these people straight. But then, you know, now in my mind, I mean, I know Tiffany, I know Michael, I know Harper, I know Lee, I know Brad, even though Brad is probably the most functional because he doesn't even show up. That was the smartest thing on his part, even though he sounds like he was a jackass. But still,
yeah.
Just skip it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because that was really good that you did that at the beginning, and also your epigraph by Peter Ustinov, who's one of my favorites.
I feel really lucky with that.
Yeah, so, yeah, what made you think of that for your epigraph?
Well, you know, I mean, I feel like when I was writing the novel, I wasn't thinking so much about, I mean, it was a very pure experience writing the novel because I didn't necessarily believe that it was going to be published. I hoped it would. And I have written novels before. My first novel, after I graduated from Iowa, the Iowa MFA program, I was only 25. And it went out to editors, and they all passed, and it was devastating at the time. But now, over 10 years later, I realized that it was probably for the better. And so, because now I'm a grown-up, and I know how to write a novel after teaching so many novel-writing workshops. So I sat down to write Cutting Teeth, sort of, you know, my motivation was to prove to myself that I could finish another book. And it was just such an amazing experience writing it because I was writing to write. So so it wasn't until, you know, I started thinking, okay, I'm almost done with this draft. I need to get one of those cool quotes to stick at the beginning.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like I saw it. I can't even remember where I saw it, but, you know, because he's, I guess, more well-known as an actor, it wasn't on a literary site that I saw it, but as soon as I saw it, I just knew that, it had to be in the book. And I think that the, I don't have my book in front of me, but...
It's, parents are the bones on which children cut their teeth.
Yes. And I think, you know, probably it's the parents who are going through more change and sort of like cutting their teeth on this, you know, intense and somewhat brief period of life. You know, now that my children are almost 5 and my son's going to turn 7 tomorrow, actually, you know, I can look back on those earliest years, you know, before they were 4 and 5, before they were in school, when I was home with them all day long and trying to run Sackett Street, and realize that that kind of intensity, it's a very brief phase, you know, in your life. I mean, you're a parent forever, but those early years. And so I think, you know, I do think of it as the parents also cutting their teeth in this new phase of life.
Definitely. And it's funny how you have this thread of Buddhism passing through the book in order to kind of juxtapose what's happening with these materialistic type people who have all these worries and all these pills they have to deal with. And I interviewed this woman yesterday who wrote this book called The Dark Sacred Night. And her epigraph was by this guy, James Lapine, who wrote Into the Woods, a musical with Stephen Sondheim. And her epigraph was every knot was once straight rope. Which is, you know, basically everybody's life. So these Buddha babies, these kids are all Buddha babies, or they were, they're kind of unlearning it. But these Buddha babies all were straight rope. It's the parents who are all tied up in knots. Look at Nicole.
Yeah.
Look at Nicole. And then you write about how you're like Nicole.
Yeah. Yeah, I am. You know, I mean, it was too impossible not to hide that one because I've written so many, you know, when your book is about to be released. And it just came out, actually, it came out on the 13th. So it's really only been out for, I've been doing so many readings that I can barely remember what day of the week it is. But so I've written a lot of essays that are being published right now, you know, as, you know, to help promote the book. And for me, you know, the book was so personal in some ways that, you know, I know that a lot of writers are sort of like, oh, you know, they want, if a character is really revealing their own personal flaws and insecurities, which basically all of our characters do, you know, they might want to hide it. But for me, I mean, really the biggest motivation, early motivation for writing this book was the anxiety that I experienced in my, you know, early years of parenting and during pregnancy. And so that was Nicole, the character that opens the book. And again, like, you know, your Fellini reference, right? Like, it's a hyper real version of my experience and the experiences that I observed other parents having.
I bet you have a to-go bag. Do you have a go bag?
You know, I have a go bag, but I haven't updated it in so long that I'm sure all the food is past the expiration date. But no, not like, occasionally I'll think like, hey, maybe, you know, I'm sure there's like thousands of parents in New York City who have really awesome go bags.
There's a company called Black Umbrella that charges you like $50 for a roll of duct tape that you could have bought at Home Depot.
I mean, it's very much rooted in real life, you know. It's amazing how you can read something and be like, oh my gosh, this is so, you know, crazy and fictional, and then you're like, no. I know people like this, and I'm kind of like that too, but yeah, I mean, I have people sometimes when they finish reading the books, like my, you know, people that I know, they're like, yeah, I've been thinking about making a go bag ever since I read your book.
Yeah, I know. I have one, but I didn't create it. My 12-year-old daughter did. And there's things in it. I look through it every once in a while, and she's put strange things in there, like one can of Campbell's soup and maybe like three Triscuits. It's just...
She's so savvy.
A deck of cards, which is, you know, a great thing to have. But it's just hilarious. And she has emergency box written outside of it and all kinds of drawings and little decals and things like that. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and it's part of our, you know, it's part of our awareness and our perspective and the way in which we see the world, especially, you know, post 9/11, I think, you know, and... I mean, even though I grew up, like, at the tail end of the Cold War, you know, so, like, I remember, like, you know, like, all those action movies that were, like,
right.
Russia was the enemy. And so I think it's just sort of part of the human experience. And then, you know, for me, it's just incredible material to write about. And also, like, as a, you know, many writers and many people, I write to inform myself of myself and how I feel about certain things and how I use writing to make sense of my place in the world. And so for me, writing is very, you know, personal. And probably if I knew this book was definitely going to be published when I was writing it, I wonder sometimes if I would have been able to be as honest, you know.
Speaking of which, you know, since we're doing this to sell your book, I never really you need to give a summary of your book, because I'm talking about it because I read it and I know everything about it. But why don't you tell all of our listeners, just give a, like a thumbnail sketch real quick so we can go off from there.
Sure. So it's about a group of 30-something couples, and as you mentioned, one Tibetan nanny that... they go away for a weekend, end of summer weekend together. And they know each other because they all have children the same age, and the young children go along with them on the trip. And the Tibetan nanny, Tenzin, has watched several children in the group, but she's working for this one character, Lee, whose husband does not go on the trip. And every character has, like all of us, a secret that they are keeping not just from their friends and the people in the playgroup, but also often from their partners, you know, their wives, their husbands. And, you know, they're working very, very hard to keep this secret contained. And I use the structure, the novel alternates between the characters' perspectives, because I wanted the reader to feel like they had this omniscient, almost voyeuristic knowledge of everything that was going on in all the characters' heads, even though the other characters don't know what each other's secrets are. And so I wanted to create that sort of, you know, somewhat isolating experience that you can have when you're a young parent, you know, with small children, and you're worrying about other parents judging you or looking like a bad parent, so you're trying to appear as calm and collected as you can possibly be with very tiny children running around. So, of course, they go away for a weekend to a beach house, and the beach house is ironically called Eden. Hmm. And as most vacation stories turn out, it turns out to be somewhat of a disaster, and secrets are revealed. Friendships are tested, relationships are damaged, and so, yeah.
It's funny because, I meant to tell you, the May 12th cover of The New Yorker is by Roz Chast, and it's like 12 panels
yes.
of cards. Did you look at it?
I was like, oh my gosh, this is like cutting piece in an abbreviated
I'm so glad you looked at it, because I couldn't explain it to you. But yeah, as soon as I saw it, I went, "Oh my God, this is what a great! This is like Cliff Notes. It's like Spark Notes."
And I even put it on my refrigerator.
Oh, that's so cool. It's funny because you know how she calms down. She has to calm down when she sees the two parents behind her. She can't be mean to her kid anymore. It's like when people come into my bookstore with their little kids, they talk to them, knowing that other people are listening. You know how that works. And it's so funny because you know that's not... Okay, come here, hon. Yeah. Oh, no, we don't do that. We don't throw books in the little pond there. No, we don't do that. You know.
Yeah, they have a discussion yeah. about it.
Use your words. And that's the thing. It's everything in your book. It's like, use your words. Hello, friend. And all those yeah. things. And,
Yeah. And I wasn't raised like that as much because my parents are older, you know, than most... I'm 37, so most of my friends' parents are younger. My father is an immigrant, you know, from Italy, was raised in a very different way, grew up during World War II in Italy. My mother comes from an Irish, you know, Catholic working class family. So, like, they were like, cut it out. You know,
well,
so.
Yeah, it's like I saw this, Jerry Seinfeld has this internet TV show called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and it's on Hulu. It's really good. But he has the comedian... Yeah, it's three seasons, and it's free. But he has Louis C.K., the comedian, on, and they're driving around.
Oh, my gosh, I love him.
Yeah, and he's so mean, but he's not that mean. Well, actually, there's two things I want to tell you about him. I end up talking more than you. I'm sorry about this. But
this is great. I love it.
But anyway, he's like, Jerry, they're talking about putting kids to bed, and they're saying, you know, you have soothing time, and you have reading time, then you have quiet time, talking time. And they both said, look, the way it was supposed to be is you just throw the kid into bed and you say, go to sleep and shut the door. And that's it. And that's the way it should be. Go to bed. And and then Louis C.K. is talking about, which is touches your book a little bit, is he talks about how he's this old, but he's got a kid who's in fourth grade, and every morning he's got to drive the kid, then he's got to pick the kid up and all this driving around. And he goes, you know, it really sucks. And then I think back, hey, wait a minute. Someday I'm going to miss this.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel, too.
Yeah.
But,
I already feel that a little, you know, with my children. I mean, it's kind of amazing that this book came out just as I'm starting to have more, you know, freedom, you know, and more time to work, even though I'm always overwhelmed running the business and taking care of the kids. But now that they're in school, I do start to have that, like, wow, that was it. Yeah. Like, they're grown up, you know?
Well, what you have is you have that afternoon that Lee is about to lose is what you have. You mean,
right.
you have that. You want that, you know, you need that, and it's so important to Lee that she has
yeah.
that.
And it's funny, you know, I mean, it's almost like it's such an intense in-the-moment time because you're just so busy doing when you're taking care of kids. It's like, you know, especially when they're really little, it's like, feeding, diapering, nap, getting them to nap, getting them to sleep. And, you know, it's you don't have a lot of, I mean, or any reflective time. And so, you know, with my first child, I was so worried about doing everything perfect. You know, like, am I doing a good job? How come is he happy? Is he feeling, you know, it was just, I just worried so much. And I felt like I wasn't able to experience in a certain way that I was when I had my second child. And I realized that, you know, I'm just going to do whatever feels easiest and right, you know. And I was able to. So I really do think that first parenting experience is just so, especially in this age where we have so much information, you
yeah.
know, like in the book. The parents are constantly online on these anonymous message boards, the only places where they feel that they can be honest because it's anonymous and they're not going to be judged for their insecurities or their fears. And they're constantly searching for, am I doing a good job? Am I doing the right thing? Am I a good parent? Am I a good person? It's a very, very different experience from the last generation.
Yeah, people can't self-validate anymore. They, you know,
yeah.
And what's really funny, I mean, my life is weird in a lot of ways, but I have a 33-year-old son, a 31-year-old daughter, a 16-year-old daughter, a 12-year-old daughter. I have a 19-month-old granddaughter and a 4-week-old grandson. So, my point is that my daughter-in-law, Kenzie couldn't go out for 3 months out of the house. No talcum powder because you can't breathe in talcum powder.
Yes, that's right. That's the new thing. Yeah.
We had to wear masks when we went in. And my daughter, the emergency box daughter, she still wears, just because she likes to, she still wears the mask as soon as she goes in. She has a really weird sense
of humor. Oh, my God, I love your family.
And but Katie, on the other hand, I just went down. I hope they're not. Well, no one's going to listen to this. Hopefully for you, they will be. But my daughter, Katie, I just went down there. Her husband was gone for a week, so I just hung out for a week with her. We went out to dinner 3 times, out to lunch 2x. We went to Home Depot. We went to the wine store.
All with the baby.
All with the baby.
Yeah.
3-week-old baby and no problems, nothing, you know. And it's just a question of how you feel about these things. And like Katie, my daughter, said, you know, it's like, if he needs talcum powder, I'll use it. But if he doesn't need it, I won't. And that's it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, and with the book, you know, I was trying, even though I wasn't thinking of this as I was writing it, but I know that I needed to show that there's this, you know, there's this infinite diversity of parenting experiences, especially mothering experiences. And a lot of it is dependent on factors that you can't control, like whether you can have a baby or whether you need to adopt a baby or whether, you know, you had a good birth or whether you were, like, you know, have trauma to kind of go through because you had a terrible birth. And depending on your personality and your, you know, biochemistry, I mean, there's so many different factors. And I think that we're still, that the idea of mother, you know, in our society is still very black and white. And so I hoped, you know, I hope that I was able to show a lot of different experiences, and that's why I was so happy when my editor let me keep all the characters' perspectives.
Well, that's what's so cool about it. I mean, the coolest thing about the book really is that you really feel, you have almost visceral emotions regarding each character. I mean, you're really, well, and, you know, it's like the way you talk about, you hope your readers aren't too hard on Tiffany.
I know.
But, I mean, you can't really help it. She's a bitch. I mean, and she does a lot of things that are really nasty, especially when she's in the shed with him while, you know, while Chase is...
Don't get... No spoilers.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. But I didn't say anything. I just said she's in the shed.
I know. I'm just joking. It's okay.
But if you go through them, I went through your family tree, and I put a D for dysfunctional, and then I was going to put an N for normal, but I really couldn't find any N's. So,
right.
But like I was thinking, you know, Nicole obviously is a very dysfunctional person, and Josh, I was thinking, well, is he dysfunctional or is he just doing the very, very best he can and just can't take it anymore? But is he a regular nice guy?
I mean, I don't believe that any kind of regular people exist.
Yeah.
Like, everybody has something dysfunctional, whether they're showing it or not. Maybe some people are just really good at hiding their dysfunction.
Well, it's like, you know,
you know, they're what we call functional people. But, you know, I mean, the book very much is, you know, I don't know if it's because I'm personally dysfunctional or I almost need to believe that everyone has flaws and insecurities and vulnerabilities and dark secrets, because there's something about believing, or there's something about living in a world where everybody is vulnerable that comforts me. You know, it's almost like humanity redeeming to think that everyone is flawed. And also, it just makes for a better story.
Yeah, and like that, the author I interviewed yesterday, she said, you know, someone who tells me they have no regrets for their life is either lying or they haven't really lived a really full life. And
yeah, and they might not be lying to... I mean, it's all about perception, you know, which is another reason why I was so excited to be able to show so many different perspectives. You know, we all have a sort of delusional definition of what is good and bad and dysfunctional and non-dysfunctional and good mommy and bad mommy. And then, you know, that's our sort of, you know, somewhat like it's our sort of coping method, our way of making sense of the world, but it's different for everyone. And so, you know, I mean, I started this parenting confessional Tumblr that, like, a week before the book came out, and it went viral almost immediately. It's called Parenting Confessional, and it's on Tumblr. And we've received like hundreds and hundreds of these anonymous confessions. And, you know, probably all of them in some way could be labeled dysfunctional.
Well, you know, yeah, but you know. But the thing is, you did write a book. Okay, well, look at it this way. I mean, if someone walks by a... Now you said about spoilers, so I don't want to say anything about the book. But okay. If someone walks by a counter and collects all the knives and hides them... Or if someone's thinking when they walk by a counter, oh, here's a knife. Well, if I took that knife, I could do something with it to someone I love very much. You know, that's the first notational thing they think of when they go by. Or, you know, if you have a child like Harper, who I despise. Did you want me not to despise her? What did you want me to do with her?
You know, I mean, I do.
I'm not that good. I'm not that good a person not to despise her.
I mean, with Tiffany, you know, I think that I hope that the characters whose perspectives that the readers are in, if there is a moment, even if it's just like, you know, a moment where you sort of understand why Tiffany is the way that she is, or see her struggling for even just a moment to control some of her urges, and if there's just a flicker, like just a moment where the reader can feel a bit of sympathy for her, for me, that's enough, you know, to have that tiny little moment of redemption. And I know that not everyone is going to be able to have that moment with Tiffany. But I have been getting these amazing reactions from book bloggers that are writing reviews. And it's so much fun to read their reviews because they say things like, at some point in the book, I hated this character, and then at other points of the book, I liked them, and then I hated them again, and then I liked them. And it made for a really interesting reading experience.
It's going to be very interesting.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. But like, it's such a great book club book, and it will be at our book club at Wellington, at my bookstore.
Ooh, exciting.
And you can come down. I mean, that would be great if you could come down.
Oh, I would love to. I love talking to people, and I'm so grateful to have readers. You know?
It's not that far away from where you are anyway. It's only, if you can get on the Excelets, you'd be here in an hour.
I would love to.
I'll pick you up.
Yeah, that would be great.
So what I was going to say was, and you even do book club discussion questions on your website.
Right.
And then, it's great for book clubs because the best book for book clubs are ones where people can get into big fights at the book club.
Yeah.
So if you do go to Rip,
yeah,
I mean, do you feel like he...
I feel like Rip gets away with a lot because he's a guy. I really do. I feel like readers that I've...
Oh, come on.
...that I've had will forgive Rip before Tiffany.
That's actually very interesting because Tiffany, even though I do feel, you know, now this is like an epiphany, no pun intended, but I feel she's a very strong person and she does what she wants to do and she knows what she wants, and if it's wrong, she'll still do it anyway. Whereas Rip is what would normally be a stereotypical picture of a woman who is helpless and not sure of what she wanted to do. He doesn't have the, you know, the whatever, the cojones to do anything. Whereas
that's
she,
right.
Well, she'll push her
There's
way through.
There's some
anything.
Men like that.
Yes. Caring, nurturing father. Caring, nurturing stay-at-homes.
And part of that, like, playing with gender identity was really important for this book, I think, because I do think that, like, in Rip's section, one of his first sections, he talks about how the definition of being a father has changed, you know, and how, like, now he's the one that asks for the tissue and therapy, and I think that they're, you know, I think that the identity of fathers in this generation, you know, from my father's generation, which
was
a long time ago, has changed more than, you know, mothers. I mean, it's just so different.
Just hugging or saying I love you.
Yeah.
Which is a very hard thing.
I mean, it's a really incredible change for, like, the definition of masculinity and you know, and fatherhood and responsibilities. And it has a lot to do also with this great, you know, discussion that's really just starting to be had in mainstream media about motherhood, the balance between motherhood and work. You know, that can women be ambitious, have fulfilling careers, and be successful and have a family life, you know? I mean, there's definitely, you know, if a family has a mother and a father in it, there's going to have to be negotiation in terms of the gender equality in order for that to happen, you know?
Well, look what you did with Rip and Grace. You know, you flipped the roles almost completely. Grace is what the kind of guy who would normally play golf all weekend long for 8 to 12 hours and come home and see the kid and, you know, maybe do, but she's totally disinterested. He's whatever he is. And then of course what happens is there's poor Hank, you know?
Yeah.
And then what do you do about Hank? I don't know. What would I do? What would you do? Would you run out to the store and do all the things he did at the very end? That kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it really depends. I really think that, you know, I think what happens is we go into parenting thinking that, like, you know, I mean, no one, I feel like the cliche, the truest cliche there is that you don't know what parenting is going to be like or what kind of parent you're going to be like until you have a child, you know, and you can fantasize about it and worry about what kind of parent you're going to be. But also, like, no one told me, right, that, like, my baby was going to be born with a personality. You know, and so you have, you know, it's not just you now. You know, you have all these different negotiations to sort of, you know, balance, like, your personality and needs, your child's personality and needs, your partner, and the dynamic that's created, you know, with all of that in the family. So it's just such a fascinating. It's just fascinating material to write about because it's so psychologically complex.
And it's like, again, my funny, hilarious daughter, you know, she says, you get what you get and you don't get upset.
And That's one of the famous sayings. Even my kids know that one by heart.
And that's like with Chase, you know, it's a very important thing, but you get what you get. And then you do the very best you can. And then that is a redeeming quality for Tiffany. Look how Chase just loves her, and look how easy it is for her to handle him, and Tenzin too. But
I mean, I also sort of, I mean, even though yes, Tiffany makes very bad choices, very bad. In the end, she's the character that you're like, she's gonna be okay, you know, because she's already reinvented herself many times, and because my father, because part of my story is very much the American dream story because of my father and my mother, you know, I, in many ways, reinvented myself, you know, by going to Iowa. And I really am very different from a lot of people in my family.
It's hard to do.
And they think it's kind of crazy that I write.
But it's a hard thing to do, too, to reinvent yourself. Though people don't change, you know, it's really hard to change.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I followed my heart, you know, excuse the cliche, but like I knew that I wanted to talk about books. I knew that that's what I wanted to do with my life. And I was very lucky that I got into Iowa. And getting into Iowa for me was like probably the biggest moment in my life because it gave me the permission to take myself seriously, where even though my parents are very smart, you know, very intelligent and supportive, I don't think I would have ever believed that you could be a writer or run a writing school, you know, coming from where I come from. So Iowa was the permission.
It's so amazing.
And now I run this workshop that has had over 2,500 students. And
yeah, I can't believe how many it is. When I read about it, I thought, okay, it starts with this many. I guess they probably have like 200 or 300 now. And then I saw 2,500. Wow.
Yeah, well, I started the Sacred Street Writers Workshop over 11 years ago, and I just put an ad on Craigslist, and it started out as this tiny class with 8 people in my home, but I was so young and so craft-obsessed that I made everybody work really hard, and it got this reputation as this workshop for serious writers. So that's the kind of writer that even though we offer all levels of classes, most of our students are what you would call advanced. You know, like they've had writing and writing class experience. So it's a very small sort of demographic. And then even though we do offer some beginning and some intermediate classes, the easiest classes for me to fill are the Fiction 3. And a lot of those students go on to MFA programs a lot. I mean, a huge amount, and a lot, and actually every year someone goes to Iowa, at least one or two, sometimes three people, Sackett writers, and they're also starting to publish books, so it's so much fun to have, we have a reading series at Book Court in Cobble Hill, and we have all these instructors and Sackett writers who are you know, sharing their new books with the community. It's just, I feel very lucky.
I know, it's so amazing, especially at my age, you know, when I, you know, when you're looking at the New Yorkers 20 under 40, and, you know, I've interviewed like Rivka Galchen and Karen Russell, and
and
you know, they were roommates. How does it happen that they were roommates and they both turn out to be these incredible, incredible writers? And there's so many, Tia Olbrecht, and
yes, she's great,
and Gary Steingart, and you know, all those guys. he was hilarious.
He is so funny.
I know. And there's this documentary on YouTube, I don't know if you've seen it yet, about him blurbing, because he's like the most...
Oh, yes, totally.
You got to watch the documentary, because he blurbs everything. And then he's talking about blurbing, and he goes, you know, I think it's better to blurb without actually looking at the book. I think you come at it from a different angle, you know. You don't have to, you don't have any...
He's so funny. His book trailer was the only trailer that I've ever
seen. Oh, I know. I have it posted on my website.
Oh, my gosh, it made me laugh so hard.
There's another one like that too called The Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant. And the whole trailer is about, why the hell did you write a book with a title like that?
But that's by Alex Scoveri, right?
Yeah, and he came to our store. He came to our store with the woman who wrote Heft. What was her name?
He teaches at Sackett Street.
Really?
Yeah.
He's a really nice guy. Yeah,
he teaches a ton of classes, and his students love him. I feel very lucky to have him teaching for us.
Oh, that's great. That's really cool. Yeah. That and the Roz Chass cartoon have made this interview perfect for me. So now, going back to selling your book, and this is the easiest way to sell it, is the fact that you write really, really good sex scenes. And I don't mind saying it, since you've talked about it.
No one ever asks me about the sex scenes.
Yeah, that one article they did.
Oh, yes, that's true. That's true. I feel like I've gotten a little bit of a reputation as someone who writes about sex, even though this is the first time that I've really written about it. But I wrote an essay for the Millions last year about writing, it's called, oh my gosh, I can't remember what it's called, A Sentimental Education, and it's writing sex and emotion in literary fiction. And it received this huge response, and it was just amazing. I had literary writers emailing me and being like, thank you, I've been so scared, because, you know, often in advanced fiction workshops and at MFA programs, no one's writing sex scenes.
I know.
They're sort of avoiding them, or they're writing sex scenes where there's not a lot of emotion. You know, it's sort of like this spare, emotionally distant description.
Or not at all.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Michael Smirkanish, who I interviewed a couple weeks ago, the guy on CNN who interviewed us, Obama and all that, he wrote a novel about a talk show host, and he goes, you know, I couldn't get beyond closing the bedroom door. And he said, so I just didn't, you know, I couldn't do it, so I didn't.
And I think that it's not as hard to get away with it as you think, because a reader, you know, especially Americans are a little, you know, we do have a reputation of being a little prudish, and, there's a really great essay that Gina Frangello, who's a wonderful author, wrote that's on BuzzFeed today that you should check out.
I'm writing it down.
Because it's about writing about sex and also writing about mothers and sex, and she's just incredible. And so in this essay, I sort of talked about how I actually used James Salter as an example, because his sex scenes are really well written, but there's no emotion,
mm-hmm.
you know, intentionally. And I think that writers fear sentimentality, literary writers specifically, who want their readers to have a challenging reading experience, you know, they fear sentimentality and melodrama so much because that's what we were taught, you know, so intensely in our writing workshops, like, show, don't tell, like, don't tell emotion, don't be sentimental, that, like, it's almost like we have to push ourselves to infuse emotion, and particularly in a sex scene where we're already feeling, like, a heightened emotion and insecurity. So, I mean, when I sold Cutting Teeth to my editor, it had maybe one sex scene in it. I think it was between Allie and Susanna, which is almost like a botched sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved it, and she was sort of like, don't you think, you know, there, and she basically pointed out places where it was like there was a missing sex scene, or there was a missing moment of sexuality or tension. And I was like, oh my God, I, like, subconsciously, you know, missed writing that scene to avoid sort of the, like, you know, anxiety of writing it.
Well, it's so funny because
when I,
you really have, yeah. You actually have two botched sex scenes.
Yes. Well, you know, they are parents to young children.
Yeah, I know, but it's like, you know, it made me feel kind of like, oh, because I, you know, and that's what's so good about it, because I remember exactly like that one, well, the, yes, I can remember exactly, where after a while, it's just, you know, I don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want there to be too much sex in there, because they are parents to young children. I wanted it to be believable.
Well, when you said I was spoiling it because I used the word shed, that scene was, you know, there wasn't much sentimentality there. It was just pretty much, you know.
Yes.
That was really good. It was very good.
Thank you. I was very proud of that scene. And after I wrote it, I was like, I can't believe I just wrote that. I was so proud of myself because, you know, all those years that I was at Iowa. And also, you know, I learned a lot from teaching writers. So I realized that I've been teaching like 10 years of advanced writing workshops, and many of the workshops that I teach are filled with writers who already have MFAs. And there was just no sex. And, you know, and there was that kind of closed door. It was like the shade is drawn, you know. And so then, you know, occasionally I would have to be like, okay, let's talk about why there's no sex scene here, you know, and everyone would just kind of like look down at their papers. I realized that it had a lot to do with, like, worrying about being overdramatic.
Also, it's like, you know, America's not going to accept any more, like, you know, Doris Day, Rock Hudson kind of movies where...
Yeah.
It's just, you know...
I know, but the literary writers, you know...
I know. The worst is science fiction writers. Like, I love reading science fiction, so when you read Robert Heinlein or Ray Bradbury or Theodore Sturgeon...
Yes.
They couldn't do it. They just couldn't do it. And when they tried, like, Isaac Asimov, because they're all nerds. And so they probably have never had sex. And... And then they try to write it, and it's just horrible. And then I had this friend, Paul, he wrote a manuscript, and he wanted me to edit it. And there was one sex scene in it where the worst part was that the bed they were sitting in, the bedspread was of planets and stars. That's what it was pictures of. And he talks about them having sex, and then the last line of the chapter is, and they came within minutes of each other. I said, Paul, I don't think that's the way it's supposed to work.
Plus minutes, that's kind of like, you know, subjective. I don't know.
You're true. I guess
how many minutes?
I don't know. They must have had a stopwatch.
But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting because you do have to be able to shift the tone, you know, so that it's not so abrupt that the reader's like, okay, we're entering the sex zone. And I think that, you know, I can imagine that in science fiction, if you're writing from sort of like a, you know, often science fiction is written in third person. It has like a little bit of an omniscient distance. You know, I think it's easier to write about sex when you're very close to a character's perspective. Because
well, also,
then you can use sensory details like smell and taste in a way that it's not breaking the tone and the momentum so that it's like, the reader is feeling any kind of jarring shift.
But you really get a running start with Tiffany, because even from, like, page one, every guy who's reading it wants to with Tiffany. I mean,
yeah, I've been reading Rip's breast section a lot.
Yeah.
And it's people almost always love it. I read it to like a bit of a stiff crowd the other night, and there was no laughter, and I was like, oh, but it's hard to read because I have to say the word breasts like 35 times, and I don't have a lisp, but it starts to make me feel like I do. But my husband did help me with that section. He read that chapter, and he was like, I think maybe
you're
thinking a little more about their breasts.
Yeah, it's like that episode.
Really?
It's like that episode of Seinfeld where they're doing the pilot, and George is looking down the dress of that 15-year-old daughter of the guy who's doing the pilot. Because Jerry just, like, motioned with his eyes, and then the guy goes by and he goes, did you get a good look, Costanza? And George says, Jerry, you told me to do it. He goes, no, you just take a peek. You just take a peek.
I miss Seinfeld.
Me too. I watch all the bloopers on YouTube. The bloopers are the best, especially with
Elaine. Oh, yeah, I should do that.
That's
a good idea.
Yeah, watch all seasons of the bloopers, and you're already in love with Elaine anyway, but you'll really be in love with her after that because she just can't help herself from breaking up constantly.
Oh, maybe I'll do that tonight. Oh, no, I have a reading. Maybe tomorrow night.
If you do it, you'll end up staying up till like 4, like I do. Who else can we talk about? Poor Chase?
Yeah, well, you know, sorry, I'm having allergies.
Me too. Ragweed ankle.
Lee's storyline was really important to me because, my son had some early delays, and now he's doing just amazingly well. He's in a regular class. He reads chapter books on his own. He's like smart. You know, he was always very smart, but he just happened to develop, which happens a lot with boys, at a different rate. And so I did have a lot of experience with like the early intervention, and New York City is an amazing place to live for that. You know, I mean, you can get so much help and therapy and counseling that will help you sort of, you know, parent a child who's developing differently. And I knew that was something that I had to write about in the book, that kind of parenting experience where you're worrying so much about your child, you know, being accepted by other children and also other parents. And also you being accepted because your child isn't fitting some sort of, you know, norm that is established by, I have no idea who, but, so that was a very, also personal. I mean, there's parts in all the characters that are me, even in Rip. Like there's traits in all of them.
It's interesting because it's like, and I have a good analogy for this. It's like with the way that both Tiffany and Tenzin are able to deal with Chase. Sometimes when I have an author signing and not many people show up, I feel so horrible, you know? And the author says, hey, everything's fine. I don't care if there's 5 or 50. I mean, I just want to come here. The experience is great. I just want to talk to people.
Right.
And they feel fine. They're happy. And I, like, just miserable. And it's like the way Lee is, you know, with Chase, she has to do so much work to just kind of, you know, make sure he's not bothering people or whatever, whereas Tenzin and Tiffany just accept, and, you know, he changes. He's different with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, like, it's a very hard thing to do, not, you know, to control when you're a parent, is especially if you're very analytical and self-scrutinizing and insecure, and Lee is at this incredibly insecure time.
She ought to be.
In her life, because she's done this terrible thing with, you know, stealing money, and
stop spoiling it.
I know. You know, sometimes in the summaries, though, they give that one away.
Kirkus is the worst. They tell the whole story.
It's like summer. I know. I don't know why. Ugh.
And Wikipedia does, too.
So Lee has a secret that is actually a secret that's more, I think, more rooted in the real world because it's something that could, you know, have such big consequences that she could lose her life with her family. And so I think in that fragile state, you know, she's already incredibly insecure, and It's funny because she, you know, I feel like she could be looking at Chase and seeing him in a more heightened, like, in more heightened danger. Like, maybe, you know, like my, you know, when my son was having so many delays, you know, he didn't talk for a very long time, and he had a very hard time not moving. You know, he would just run back and forth from one end to the apartment for, like, I mean, all day. And we were, and our parents were really, it was very hard for them to believe that he was, you know, getting all this therapy. And then at a certain point, they realized that it was, like, the best thing that, you know, could have ever happened for him. But, you know, you doubt your perception as a parent constantly. Like, is this the right thing to do? You know, there's so many choices. There's so much information to sift through and so many different parenting philosophies. Like, you know, leave them alone and let them learn on their own, or, you know, work with them every day and kind of hover over them, like attachment parenting and this kind of parenting. And I think that, you know, sometimes, even though we're so lucky as mothers now that we have so many choices, it can almost feel like too much.
Yeah, I think it is too much. I liked it when Michael was born and I had a $19 umbrella stroller, and that's basically it. You know,
that's right. Your perspective is so unique because you've seen such, I mean, different. Wow, that's
like
amazing.
That Mama Ruth thing drives me crazy. You know what that is? The thing that...
No, what's that?
The Mama Ruth is the thing that you put them in and it just bounces around and swings around rhythmically, and you just lay the baby in there, and you could theoretically leave the baby there for the first 4 years of its life and he'd be happy.
Wow.
It just bounces up and down and goes left and right and circular, and then you can insert your iPod into it. It's amazing.
I mean, my kids were incredibly active, and that was part of, like, my son was so active. He crawled at 5 months. He walked at 9. It was like... And so my sort of parenting experience, you know, like at the playgroups, like I didn't get to sit and, you know, chit-chat with the moms for that long because my kid was like up and running towards the, you know, non-baby-proof electric outlet.
It reminds me of the Roz Chass cover again.
Yeah, so that they were busy, you know, and now they're like super alert, like friendly, social people, you know, they're just amazing. Like, there's nothing chill about and I'm not chill, so, you know, I shouldn't have been so surprised. But it's amazing how different everyone's experiences can be. And then you look at someone else's experience, and you're like, their child's like this, and they're like this kind of parent, and I'm the opposite. And is that bad or good? And really, it's just all good, because everyone has a different, you know,
It's all situation. So... You make it all so real in the sense that everything is so busy now. There isn't, that's why I think the seminal moment of the book, like kind of that it pivots on, and it comes at the right spot in the book timing wise, is when Tenzin reaches into the trash can to get the half eaten banana out.
It's so good. You like that. That's great.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's like, this is the way things are. This is the way things are. It's better if, I don't want to say should or whatever, it's better if you take that banana out and use it for what nature and God and whatever you want to believe in, meant it for. And that kind of is like a gnomon for the entire book, you know, just take it easy.
And, you know, Tenzin is based on, you know, when I could finally afford childcare, I had a bunch of babysitters that were, you know, they were okay, and they were only there for like 6 hours a week. But my son was very active, and at that time, he was challenging. And they, you know, I just couldn't find someone who was patient enough with him, and it made me nervous to leave him. So I didn't write for many years because I had to use whatever free time I had to run the business, to run Sacket Street. And so finally I met this woman at a playground. She was a Tibetan woman who, like, very much like Tenzin, you know, her family was an Indian. She was working to get asylum. And we became friends. And when I was able to afford her, you know, I had her watch the kids, and that was when I was able to go back to writing, because I knew that the kids would be with someone that I trusted. And she was very patient with my son. In fact, I feel like she loved him more, you know, than, you know, I mean, she was wonderful with my daughter, but because she knew that he needed that extra.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, that extra love. And she came to my book launch the other night, and I, you know, I mean, there were like hundreds of people there. It was incredible. It was a record for Book Court, and
cool.
Probably the best night of my life.
Huh.
And I saw her in the crowd, and when I saw her, I almost started crying because that was so meaningful, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about her for some more, but you realize we've been talking for almost an hour? Holy mackerel.
Yeah, that's a long time. I don't know how long you usually talk.
I talk until the author tells me they're sick of me and hangs up.
Oh, okay.
I would like to sit in your car with you right now and talk
that's
for another 2 hours.
That's dangerous for you. You better watch out, because there's some authors who will like talk to you for the rest of their lives.
I know. There's some, and then there's some that say, I've had enough of this. So, but no, this has been great. And I would like to talk again. And when it comes out in paperback, we can do another one, because it's going to be, depending on your timing, it's going to be like the best beach read ever. For good or for bad.
Sure. I like that. Yes, you tell me when.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you and meeting you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, that was Julia Fierro talking about her new book, Cutting Teeth, released last month. If you are a parent, a young parent with small children and are in a playgroup, this is a book for you to read. Next week, we will have Corinna Wolf, who's going to discuss her book, The Insomniacs. It's a great kids' book, and it's illustrated beautifully. And I look forward to talking to her about it, because it's the first time I will have interviewed anyone who's written a children's book. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.